forgive the pun, but we don't, in some respects, want to instrumentalize music learning as a way perhaps of justifying its purpose just because it enhances something else. Because I think a lot of music teachers might work in one-person departments. And that's incredibly isolating because I guess if you're working in a maths department, very likely there's a team of you. So to have a curriculum conversation is easy. I've never met a leader that doesn't value the arts, but you've got this terrible balance as a school leader. You've got to weigh up the safety and security of your staff and students against keeping and maintaining your broad and balanced curriculum. Let's not forget that whilst we do have to make these really difficult decisions, the one thing that's going to get us through the recovery of this situation is our creativity.
Welcome to the Qualified Tutor Podcast. I'm your host, Ludo Miller, and I'll be interviewing tutors and thought leaders from across the tutoring landscape to inspire, inform, and motivate you to become the best tutor you can be. The Qualified Tutor community is a safe and supportive space for tutors who love to learn and grow. We offer training, resources, ideas, and a chance to connect with like-minded tutors. If you'd like to continue the conversation, join our Qualified Tutor community at www.qualifiedtutorcommunity.org or find it in the show notes.
Welcome to Stephen Berryman, who is Director of Arts and Culture at the Odyssey Trust for Education and also a visiting research fellow at King's College London and Guildhall School. Stephen, after a varied career in several music and education-focused careers, Stephen's goal really is to ensure that arts and music education are taken seriously and that we use the lockdown period to revitalise learning through creativity and culture, two central pillars of the artistic sphere. Stephen joins us today to discuss the state of the music curriculum in the UK's current education system, as well as the importance of music in education and some of the skills that can be transferred from music to classroom learning. A very big welcome to Stephen for joining us today. And we look forward to this conversation, which follows on from some of those really very music-focused podcasts that we conducted to kind of this time last year with Orchestras for All and with Play for Progress. So we're very much looking forward to continuing that theme. So, Stephen, we often start with this question. If you've listened to this podcast before, you'll know that there's a great deal of fascinating answers that come out of this. But what kind of student were you, Stephen?
Well, probably an annoying one. I think one of my earliest memories of school really was I always used to finish work really quickly. I think for some reason I have this internal race that I had to complete the work. So as the teacher was telling you what you needed to do, I set myself the challenge of completing the work before they'd finished introducing the work you had to do. And I always remember the teacher being so annoyed, but you've done it. What are you going to do now? Because you've done what I was going to, you know, I needed you to do. So I suppose I was just endlessly needing to, I always worked quickly, but I guess I was always an annoying student for a teacher because I always wanted more. I always wanted more. I wanted the next thing. So I think that probably hasn't changed. I'm sure my colleagues would say the same thing. But, you know, I work very fast and I'm very keen to get involved in lots of things. But I think that certainly right from the beginning of my schooling, I was always that annoying student that wanted more from the teacher.
I'm sure that's got you to where you are today. No. We've had a number of responses, but I've never heard annoying before, but I saw that came out in different ways. So how long have you been working at the Odyssey Trust?
So I started the Odyssey Trust for Education back in September.
Okay.
So I got the job back in April, and obviously right at the beginning of the pandemic, and I thought it'd be fine. By September, this situation will be all over. So it's been interesting to start a new job in the middle of a very complex worldwide situation, and particularly in the subject area, you know, arts and culture, that has been hit so severely by the pandemic, not only within education, but obviously more broadly within the creative sector. You know, jobs lost, theatres aren't functioning, we can't have concerts, we can't have audiences. So there's been a huge decimation of the sector, whilst in some respects, I suppose, lots of creative industries, you know, again, that pivoting towards digital, that ability to look at streaming, you know, connecting with audiences in new ways, that has put a lot of pressure on, you know, on the sector, I imagine. But it's been brilliant to see the work that's been shared. But it does mean, obviously, those COVID restrictions which schools have had to work within, and that guidance of the DfE and the DCMS, that we haven't been business as usual in the arts. So we haven't been making and creating and performing and sharing in the way we used to. But it's been brilliant to see schools doing concerts and virtual things, but that takes considerable effort. And with various other restrictions, perhaps around bubbles, you can't do groups, you know, you can't have orchestras in the same way. But again, I think teachers have been really agile to, and, you know, ingenious in making things work. But we are at a kind of a perilous place for the arts, I think, in schools, where these restrictions, you know, have really hampered what schools can do. So there's a lot of work to do to make sure that school leaders recognise that the arts are really valuable. We do need to make sure we protect and preserve them, because they are at risk of further decline because of these restrictions we're working within.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and how would you feel then, off the, you know, right off the back of that, you know, with this greater need for support for school leaders and especially kind of music leaders within schools? How would you feel that your approach has changed to in response to this situation?
I think a big change in my approach has been pushing all my energy really towards a curriculum, because for the arts, particularly the performing arts, it's very much about creating productions, concerts, extracurricular. Whilst your curriculum obviously is very important, what happens in the classroom, so much of your energy and joy for the subject also exists beyond the classroom. And not being able to work with students in that extracurricular way, through those rehearsals, through their performances, has been a huge loss of confidence for teachers. And I felt that when I've met with music teachers particularly, you feel that collective loss of confidence. What is our subject anymore? Because we can't do so many things. So I've certainly been channeling lots of my energy, certainly when working with teachers and staff in my new role, towards let's focus on the curriculum, let's focus on the future of our curriculum, particularly at Key Stage 3. That's when we work with all students. Let's focus on making sure that when we get to September, and we're all working with that idea that September will be moving towards some sense of normality, we can be ready with a, you know, perhaps a changed curriculum. You know, what have we learned from this experience of lockdown? But also thinking about the bigger issues around the world that have been going on. Obviously, Black Lives Matter, and a general EDI focus, so equality, diversity, inclusion. So really rethinking, reimagining our curriculum, checking in with it, and asking ourselves, who are we serving with this curriculum? Are, you know, how have these young people changed during this very complex time? How might we've changed our curriculum in response to that? And where will we be in September? So I put all the energy into that, really, and not worried so much about, let's get extracurricular groups going, let's get concerts going, let's get plays going, because in a way, that's so challenging. We don't want to waste energy when we only have limited bandwidth in a very, very complex time. So for me, curriculum, curriculum, curriculum.
Yes, absolutely. And you can see, you can hear, you know, Stephen's, you know, previous pieces and talking on events and podcasts before, that this is obviously something that is very, a very, very important part of the work you do, Stephen. So, you know, off the back of that, I'd like to know, using your experience, using your insights, what do you think are going to be the challenges to come from this September for the music curriculum?
I think obviously moving out of these COVID secure practices and what that looks like will be a huge challenge. So practical work, the use of instruments, obviously there's hygiene, you know, situations around the use of instruments, having to make sure that, you know, instruments are clean, how we share them is going to be a huge issue to consider, because I don't think we can move seamlessly from the restrictions within which we're working now and just go back to normal. I think that has to be considered. Singing is a big part of a curriculum for many schools, as it is part of a national curriculum in music. And singing particularly was hit initially because it was felt that that was a way of spreading COVID more readily than normal speech, for example. And I think there has been some really successful research that has shown that that isn't the case. You know, singing and speaking are pretty much synonymous in some respects, but still, that
Stephen, would you like to conduct the rest of this in song? Would that
perhaps not? But I think actually, I think I imagine lots of music teachers will like to do that, because I think we're all missing that communal singing. But certainly having large groups of students together, as we might have done, you know, there might be choirs of 100 students across different year groups. We have to rethink that now. You know, how are we going to move out of that bubble way of working? And I guess too, some schools have been working in zoning groups of students, so it meant that you might not be teaching in your specialist spaces. So that has huge impacts on your curriculum. So by September, if there's a risk that you're not working in your specialist space, you're not able to have large congregations of students across different year groups, this is going to have an impact on your extracurricular provision. Any kind of COVID restrictions are going to have an impact on the way you use instruments and other equipment in your classroom. And I think music is one of those subjects that is quite equipment intensive, because we want to have those tools and instruments. While some pupils might have access to their own instruments, that isn't the case. We know that there are many pupils that can't afford instrumental lessons, can't afford access to instruments. So music teachers have to think really quite ingeniously about September. And I suppose we hope that we are moving towards a time where we can start to work in the ways we're used to and most comfortable in. But I think the legacy of this current situation isn't going to go away too soon. So there's quite a few issues for music teachers to grapple with. And they're very much at the mercy of school leaders. So if school leaders want to retain certain practices into the next academic year, as we, you know, try to stave off COVID cases, then that will have an impact on your curriculum as a music teacher.
Yeah, no, great challenges ahead. And in your role, Stephen, I guess you're kind of mediating that relationship between music and an arts teacher and school leader, obviously not in your role as a school leader, but in your role as director of arts and culture. So, you know, that's a great insight that you shared there. Now, I'll ask you again for some insight, Stephen. Yeah, I guess that's why you're here, is to answer some of those key questions. And you discussed in a TES article, actually from the summer of 2018, the link to it I'll pop in the show notes below. But you talked about how there is increasing evidence that kind of that learning an instrument can have a really positive impact on academic potential and academic success. I love the idea of that, and I think that, you know, on this podcast we've had several guests who've come on and spoken about that link between kind of music and academic potential, and this is a really strong theme of ours. So do you think you could give a few more insights into the evidence around that and how that area has developed?
Yeah, of course. I think Susan Hallam's work, particularly Susan Hallam and Kevin Rogers, you'll find some excellent articles in the British Journal of Music Education on this. There's certainly one from 2016 looking at the impact of instrumental learning and academic performance. And I guess there's two issues around this, because forgive the pun, but we don't in some respects want to instrumentalize music learning as a way perhaps of justifying its purpose just because it enhances something else. I think lots of music educators are keen that we pursue music, we learn instruments because we want to be better musicians. We want to enhance our knowledge, skills and understanding through and in music. So to suggest its purpose is only to enhance something else is to instrumentalize the subject, which in a way we don't want to do because we want music for music's sake. But at the same time, I suppose these studies can feel quite compelling. But at the same time, I think there might be some evidence to suggest it doesn't make a huge amount of difference. A headline in a, you know, kind of a newspaper article about some of these studies could suggest. So I don't think learning an instrument is going to transform you into Einstein. But I guess for me, what you see as a music educator is the kind of young person it creates through the experience of learning an instrument, because you develop that resilience, you develop that confidence, particularly because it might be the only time in your week when you're having a one-to-one lesson. The only time in your week where someone is giving you quite intense feedback, because they're scrutinizing you potentially for half an hour, might be shorter, might be longer, but you're being intensely scrutinized by a teacher one-on-one for half an hour. That's a very different experience to being in a classroom setting where the teacher might interact with you over the course of a lesson once or twice, but not for half an hour one-on-one. So I think it builds that resilience and confidence because you are constantly under the scrutiny of a teacher. You've got to deal with that constant feedback, But also, learning an instrument, very much like sport, is that something you have to persist with, because things don't happen immediately. It's a physical skill that requires repetition. And you have to develop those competencies with the support of your teacher to learn how to practice a new skill, how to hone it and improve it. I suppose the equivalent would be like getting the same piece of maths homework over and over and over and over again. It's unimaginable in another subject, but within music, you are doing the same thing over and over and over again, potentially over many months. And I think as musicians, we're very much used to doing that. You know, over the 35 odd years of, you know, instrumental lessons that I must have had and all the practicing, that you get used to the idea that I'm going to be working on this for months, because I want to get to the stage where I can perform this in front of others fluently and be able to communicate it in the way I want to communicate it. And that, for a young person, to have that persistence and resilience to keep practicing through, you know, the challenges of not being able to do it first time, but keep going. So that risk-taking, that dealing with failure, I think they're brilliant behaviors to cultivate through instrumental learning. Whether or not that means you get higher scores in maths or English, I'm less interested in that, but I do like the idea that it cultivates behaviors that will permeate your other academic work. So you will become more resilient in maths when you have a problem that's challenging. You'll keep going. You might have that practice mindset from music. So I hope that's what would happen. And I think that's anecdotally what we see. Whether or not the evidence is compelling enough to justify mass instrumental learning, I'm not sure we have that yet. But certainly there's lots of great projects. So the Music in Secondary Schools Trust, UK Music Masters, they work quite intensely with schools. And I think they can see the difference it makes when you start doing instrumental learning at scale with a group of young people. But again, that remains slightly anecdotal. But hopefully that research will continue, definitely. But I think it's you know, both are possible. Some people say that I've learned an instrument, it's made no difference. Some will see a difference. So it's a tricky one.
Stephen, you probably have to beware comparing learning an instrument to doing maths homework over and over and over again, because that will scare the life out of a certain proportion of students. But I do think very much that what you've been saying there about the value of learning a musical instrument and being alongside an educator one-on-one for half an hour, 40 minutes, an hour, is obviously very comparable to the tutoring situation, which is why I feel that there's so much to learn from you know, diving into an instrument as a student does, and how that compares to diving into a subject in a tutoring session. So there's a lot to share there, and I certainly feel that some of those academic areas that you're talking about that might permeate into academic learning from music learning are very much applicable to the kind of skills that will allow a student to flourish in tutoring, you know, the kind of devotion to your subject and the independent thinking and application to kind of, I guess, a niche area. Those are really important points to pull up. In your work as a committee member of the Music Teachers Association, there's obviously a lot of work that you do with determining the future of the curriculum. And we've touched on the curriculum, you know, already, but I feel there's value in returning to it. And there's obviously so much more expertise to come from you, Stephen. So can you tell us a little bit more about the work you do for the Music Teachers Association and how you're supporting music teachers with that curriculum?
Yeah, of course. So I guess as committee members, we're not paid in any way to support the Music Teachers Association. Like anyone, actually, any members, we're getting towards 800 members of the Music Teachers Association now, which is fantastic, to really connect music teachers across the UK and some beyond, which is brilliant, because I think a lot of music teachers might work in one person departments. And that's incredibly isolating, because I guess if you're working in a maths department, very likely as a team of you. So to have a curriculum conversation is easy, because you have those colleagues in your department office or in your classrooms that you can have those corridor staff room chats with about what you're teaching and how you do it, as well as those more formal moments. But often for a music teacher, you are on your own. So the Music Teachers Association does represent a chance, particularly for those music teachers who are in one person departments, to connect with that, in a sense, a large staff room of music teachers. And as curriculum lead for the Music Teachers Association, along with Catherine Barker, who is part of United Learning, who's head of performing arts, we're looking at a few strands of activity because we're really keen to kind of propel that curriculum conversation on for music teachers to really make sure we can champion our subject collectively, because we want the Music Teachers Association to be a voice for the subject, particularly during COVID when it's been at risk. Music Teachers Associations play quite a key role in advocating through Can Do Music. It's a website, hashtag Can Do Music, which was a tripartite effort with the ISM, so the Incorporated Society of Musicians, Music Mark, which is the other subject association along with the ISM and Music Teachers Association, sharing best practice during COVID to just make sure our subject can keep thriving and keep working. But as curriculum lead, me and Catherine, we've been looking at a few strands of activity. With my background, obviously kind of an academic and some research, I've been looking at how we can engage with research through our curriculum decisions and conversations. So I've been leading a blogging project with a series of curated articles from a British Journal of Music Education. So along with the two editors of the journal, we selected a range of articles. We have an article a week and music teachers can contribute a response, a reflection to the article. And we chose a range of articles which tackle the key debates in music education and some of the key debates which will underpin your decisions around your curriculum. And it's been good to see those responses coming in every week. Catherine Barker, in her work through this curriculum strand of the MTA, has been looking at the implications of cognitive science in the music classroom. Lots of these Rosenshine principles can seemingly conflict with the way we feel music might be taught, but Catherine is a wonderful advocate for actually these cognitive science approaches have quite positive implications for the music classroom. So she's been leading some webinars for staff to learn about and lead, you know, have those conversations around Rosenshine and other cognitive science areas. And we've also started some work with Emily Crowhurst, who's a head of music from School 21. She's looking at the curriculum design process. So she's been doing a project with a group of members who are interested to look quite deeply at a specific project within their curriculum and start to unpick it and tune it up to, you know, refine it. So collectively, we've got these three strands of curriculum work, which move from those bigger issues of debates, move to that pedagogical, and then move to that more precise specificity of what you're actually teaching. So we're hoping that the three strands of activities support members to enhance their ability to design and think deeply about the curriculum. And so far, it's been positively received.
Yeah, really nice. That seems like a really valuable project, you know, getting people contributing to blogs and really spreading those ideas from the individual outwards, really, rather than kind of top down, which is a really valuable way of looking and something that certainly we very much believe in. Now, I just want to turn, you know, from the curriculum to the individual, just as I've been mentioning there, you know, kind of from the wider to the specific. You touched on this subject in an article, again, in the TES from last summer, actually, you know, so very much in the middle of, or just coming out of the first wave of the pandemic, first lockdown. You talked about, you know, very fervently about why students should study, you know, arts, including music at school. And I wanted to go a little bit further into that, because now coming out of kind of second, well, not even coming out of really, we're recording this on the 4th of March, we're still very much in the second lockdown, but looking, you know, the first steps towards, you know, easing restrictions. Why do you think this is still an important area to keep in the media? Why should students continue to study the arts at school? And perhaps even how can tutors kind of help with this as well?
No, yeah, thank you. And yeah, I agree. It's interesting, when I wrote both of these articles, they were pertinent at the time, but increasingly because of the COVID situation, they've remained pertinent. And even a year or 2 years on, it's interesting how the issues are still very much, you know, omnipresent in education. I think the main risk is, as leaders are battling with how to make their schools COVID secure, and the various logistical challenges to achieve that, it means they are contemplating changes to their curriculum, changes to business as usual, which coincidentally end up undermining art subjects more than any other subject, really. And for the leaders I work with, no one makes these decisions because they don't value the arts. I've never met a leader that doesn't value the arts, but you've got this terrible balance as a school leader. you've got to weigh up the safety and security of your staff and students against keeping and maintaining your broad and balanced curriculum. And unfortunately, the art subjects are often the most risky to deliver when we look at them with the lens of COVID security, in terms of, you know, students working in groups, students being physically active, students using lots of equipment that's shared, students singing, you know, performing. So those challenges mean that there might be some leaders who are contemplating restrictions to their curriculum or changes to, say, the use of specialist spaces or changing their school day, which might result in the removal of things. But I suppose the point for my article was, and certainly through the work I've done as a kind of arts and cultural education practitioner with, you know, say the Opera House, and seeing the value of this work, and anecdotally seeing the change it makes to young people when you see their confidence grow, when you see their ability to express themselves, when you see their ability to deal with perhaps a complex social issue through the medium of a particular art form, you know that it's of huge value. So my agenda really behind that article was to make sure, let's not forget that whilst we do have to make these really difficult decisions, the one thing that's going to get us through the recovery of this situation is our creativity and our ability to express ourselves and understand what we've experienced and communicate that understanding and deal with it through the arts. So I'm very keen that all leaders and all, you know, hods of these subjects recognize that they have a vital role to play in that recovery. And there's fantastic resources. You know, A New Direction has created some brilliant resources in looking at this recovery curriculum and this resetting ourselves through creativity. So I suppose I just want to implore any teachers, really, you know, even if you're working one-to-one or if you're working in a class situation, and whatever your subject is, but how can we use our creativity? How can we teach through creativity? And there's a fantastic website that can support this from the Arts Council, which launched just at the end of last month, the Creativity Exchange. And the Creativity Exchange is about sharing the great work we see in all educational settings where we're teaching with and through creativity, regardless of a subject. So what creative ways can I teach this particular concept in science or chemistry? How can I be curious and imaginative using creativity? It might involve responding artistically to something. So it's just, I guess, reminding all subjects and all teachers that we can use creativity in all our subject areas, because we know that this is going to make a difference as people's, you know, transition and recover and reset themselves from the lockdown life and from the challenge of COVID. Because some of these young people might have experienced loss. They might have experienced, you know, grief and bereavement, or might still be doing so. And we just know that arts and cultural engagement can give a voice to those feelings, can give a way of expressing those complex emotions, particularly for younger students. So we want to really think deeply about, are we actively preventing that arts and culture and creative engagement in the choices we're making in our curriculum? How might we preserve it for the benefit of our young people?
Absolutely. Pertinent questions to raise, very much. And you know, all school leaders should be considering that, as you say. You know, you mentioned there that you've never really met a school leader who doesn't value the arts, but it's about implementing that in a way that is COVID safe. And exactly. not always particularly easier, probably much easier said than done. I just wanted to touch on, to kind of end on here, really, was, you know, you mentioned there that steps to kind of aid in our recovery and bringing us out of this situation and trying to return schools to some sort of normality, although we talked before about how, you know, the word normal, it just shouldn't really even be part of our lexicon at this point, because the post-COVID world is not going to be anything like it was pre-COVID. But part of this recovery in education will involve the use of, or the deployment of tutors. You know, obviously the National Tutoring Programme has demonstrated the government's willingness to implement tutors in the catch-up process, you know, to ease the pressure on teachers. So how, you know, in your position, Stephen, how do you see that tutors and classroom music teachers can work effectively in partnership?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think actually classroom music teachers already work closely in partnership with instrumental tutors. That's a very much an established way of working. But I hope looking forward, they might consider more ways they can make that partnership even more vibrant within their departments. Obviously, there's always going to be a cost to such work, but I can imagine a situation where we can make greater use of instrumental tutors within the music curriculum, certainly as we're starting to look to more inventive ways of making practical work work in the classroom context. It might mean dividing groups up more, separating them out across more rooms, and then working with instrumental tutors that might be working in your school already to help them work with you to make that practical work work. But I think in all the art forms, really, we have this huge workforce of cultural learning professionals who can be brilliant tutors. They could be supporting the curriculum in various ways to enhance what we do, to add that expertise, particularly in specialist areas across all the art forms. So I really hope that all art subjects might consider, how can we involve those tutors in what we do? How can they enhance and enrich and extend what's going on in the classroom through more bespoke one-to-one support or small group support? Obviously, cost is going to be an issue. And I hope what in any kind of educational recovery that's being discussed, as well as that focus on what, I hate the word, but core subjects, whatever focus there might be on those, I hope there is that reflection of a broader, more holistic picture of a young person's life. And I think we're all very much on the same side that arts and cultural engagement is a vital contribution to one's education, to what makes you human. How might we enhance and enrich that and support it with those cultural learning professionals who can make our curriculum really sing, particularly as pupils begin to return to school? So loads of potential.
Yeah, a great deal. And we look forward very much to seeing how this develops. And obviously, the Odyssey Trust are very lucky and very privileged to have you kind of working with them, Stephen, as Director of Arts and Culture. You know, that's something that you bring a great deal of expertise to the table, and you know, hopefully these, you know, what you've been expounding here in this conversation will touch a great deal number of tutors and teachers, you know, on our community that we have, community of tutors, a qualified tutor community. There are a good deal of music teachers in there, and I think that this will be very helpful for you know, giving them an idea of how they can help in the kind of this recovery period and looking beyond that. No, thank you very much, Stephen. There's a great deal to learn more, and if any listeners who would like to get in touch with Stephen, please do have a look at his website, stephen-berryman.com. There's a great deal of resources there, and you can also follow Stephen on Twitter. But we'd love to invite you back, Stephen. There's much more to learn from this. You know, I predict that in the next couple of weeks and months, you'll be writing more resources, more details, more articles that we can kind of go into more detail in this podcast. So we'd love to have you back perhaps after the end of this academic year in the summer, see kind of what insights you've taken from this final quarter of the academic year. But it's been a pleasure having you on. I hope you've enjoyed discussing these topics. So thank you very, very much. And we will, we'll be hearing from you again, Stephen, very soon.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to chat.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. Bye then, Stephen.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to the Qualified Tutor podcast, where tutors share their expertise to support the tutoring community. If you'd like to continue the conversation, join our Qualified Tutor community at www.qualifiedtutorcommunity.org or find it in the show notes below. We exist to connect, share, and learn with you, because tutoring is a small job that makes a big difference.